Yeah, so let me introduce Uther Nathsmith on the subject being state constitutions, paper and reality. So over to you, Uther.
Okay, hi all. First of all, thanks for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. Nice to see so many people have joined. Basically, I plan to give sort of over the next half hour a brief overview or introduction to an idea which I have been studying now for some time called the theory of the material constitution. I'll go into what that means in a second, but for the first sort of 10 minutes, I intend to sort of give the background on what this theory is, where it comes from, why it's relevant to socialists. The sort of second part, I intend to talk a bit about the ideas of democracy and freedom and how a socialist should sort of view these notions in light of the theory of the material constitution. And at the end, just a little bit, brief section talking about what conclusions we can draw from the theory and where we should take them, hopefully with some time for questions. If anybody has a question, feel free to put your hand up whilst I'm talking, and if I see it, I will respond. First, a very brief bit about me. So I have a degree in law from the University of Oxford and a master's degree in law for the University of Edinburgh. And the idea of the material constitution was the subject of my master's dissertation, which I finished just a couple of months ago. So sort of hot off the press, if you like. Without further ado, I will get into the substance of what I'm here to talk about. So the theory of the material constitution, the sort of core observation of this theory that sort of floats around in legal circles, is that behind the written legal constitution of a state, for example, the US Constitution, French Constitution, etc., behind the legal document lies a body of material relations, and that the content of the written legal constitution depends in some way or is determined in some way by these relations, by the way they operate or by the balance between them. As a theory in its modern form can sort of be traced back to Constantino Mortati in the 1940s, who was actually a lawyer in fascist Italy and supported the regime in fascist Italy. Similar ideas have been expressed by Carl Schmitt, a Nazi Party jurist in the 30s and 40s, and other unsavory individuals. But the basic premise of the theory about this idea of there being a separation between what the law says and how the law operates in practice is not inherently a right-wing idea. In fact, many, many Marxist, socialist, or other left-wing individuals have expressed similar views, including Ralph Miliband, Antonio Gramsci, Ferdinand Lassalle, and of course, even Karl Marx himself. I'll start with talking a brief bit about Constantino Mortati's theory, because that's basically how it's come into the public light in academic circles studying law. Mortati's theory is essentially that all constitutions have political goal and a material element, and that the second part, the material element, is the socioeconomic relationships that shape a political goal in society, make it emerge, and impose it on the general population. And crucially for him, he argues that there's no abstract society, community, nation, that these are just buzzwords in effect. And that actually the political goals of society are determined by competing power blocks, different interests battling with each other, shifting allegiances on the basis of common ground to create a political order. And so the political order, which he says lies at the heart of every constitution, be it a democratic republic or a fascist dictatorship or whatever else, he says is defined by the victorious power blocks, that they shape the constitution, regardless of what the written meaning is, that the constitution, the political principle defined by these powers that be, becomes the principle for the unification of a national community. So if you take, for example, fascist Italy in the 1930s, you might say, and I'm not an expert on history, but you might identify, for example, that the power block, the ruling power block there was industrialists, landowners, the Catholic Church. You might include these groups as the power blocks that came together to make up the political idea behind the fascist dictatorship. And then they unify a collective group of people on this basis. Of course, not all individuals subscribe to that. You have outsiders as well, but they take this political principle as their sort of the defining characteristic of the political state. Another thinker who I think is interesting to mention by way of comparison is Ferdinand LaSalle, who was a contemporary of Karl Marx and sort of a socialist type of thinker, not particularly Marxist, but certainly moved in the same circles as Marx. And he says the following, I quote, "The actual relation of forces in a given society constitutes the actively operating force which determines all laws and juridical institutions of this society." He argues that on this basis, the constitution of a state must include big industrialists and banks and all those other institutions like the military and so on that possess real power in society. And he says, "It makes no difference what is written on a piece of paper, so long as it contradicts the real state of things." That, in a nutshell, is the idea of the material constitution. And it's very relevant for socialists if we take these ideas, Marxist analysis, socialist analysis is, of course, based on an acceptance or understanding of the class system that operates in society. But more than that general point, I think if you take it to examining the society we live in today, which is supposedly democratic, supposedly free, and so on, you can draw certain conclusions by applying this theory. Now, a lot of legal academics and other academics, I'm sure a lot of people in general, believe in what I call the autonomy thesis. They argue that law is autonomous, and I quote here Christopher Tomlins, an American legal theorist, law is autonomous of the social world in relation to which it stands. In other words, it is a auto-reproductive closed system. This means that laws are made in a manner that is at least in principle disconnected from the goings on of society, something that many legal academics are very fond of saying is, well, hypothetically, the law could have any content. The law could be a fascist law or a capitalist law or socialist law, but in principle, the law could be written in any way. Now, to many people, this is instinctively a very naive way of looking at the law, because although technically we could write whatever constitution we want to, or Parliament could pass whatever laws it wants to, we all know in practice that there are certain limits to the way in which the state can exercise its authority. And the theory of the material constitution helps us as socialists to start to think about where these limits might be drawn and why. Take, for instance, the prime ministership of Liz Truss as a very, very recent and good example of what I mean by this. Liz Truss came to power with a very, very specific agenda to essentially implement her version of trickle-down economics, to water down workers' rights, tax cuts for the wealthy, and so on and so on. But immediately found that her plans were opposed by the markets, the financial markets, stock markets and so on, and banks and things took objection to her plans on the basis that they were not felt to be economically credible. And the mounting, should we say, economic crisis that this caused ultimately ended up with Liz Truss having to resign. And so although, as the legitimate, or at least legally, constitutionally legitimate government, Liz Truss, in theory, was entitled to implement whatever agenda she saw fit, she very quickly found the real limits of political and legal power, and that these limits did not lie within the state itself, within the constitution of the state, that these limits were not legal limits, but that they lay within economic factors. And generally, throughout history, this has been a problem far more for left-wing governments than for right-wing governments. Left-wing governments, being those who have sought in some way to, say, for instance, tackle inequalities of wealth or reform in some way the relations of private property, effectively socialistic or socialist adjacent movements, although not necessarily ones that this party would recognize as socialist. I quote, for instance, from Ralph Miliband, his seminal study, The State in Capitalist Society, published in 1969. He notes a systemic political and social bias against left-wing movements, which creates a hostile environment of imperfect competition between left-wing parties and right-wing parties, which is advantageous to the status quo. Lobbying, education, inherited values, the media, repressive laws, all these things factor into a society where the free communication of views which go contrary to the status quo is infinitely far harder than communicating those which support it. For instance, Miliband notes that even in the 1960s, the so-called golden age of social democracy, strikes, for example, take place under a hostile attitude, I quote, treated as industrially subversive, irresponsible, unfair, against the interests of the community, contrary to the workers' best interests, wasteful of resources, crudely aggressive, inconsistent with democracy, and in any event, unnecessary. And so for those of us who are seeking to change society, to challenge the status quo, we're faced right from the very beginning with an enormous amount of pressure, an enormous amount of opposition that is entirely one-sided, that is directed in defense of the status quo and against those who seek to change it. And indeed, And indeed, Ralph Miliband is not the only person to draw attention to this. There have been many, many accounts of media bias and so on and so forth. I would just like to share one other quote on this topic from a man called Hermann Heller, who was a member of the Social Democratic Party of Germany and a very, very esteemed legal theorist in the 1920s during the Weimar Republic. And he writes, quote, "In virtue of their superiority in the economy and in everything that concerns civilization, the rulers have adequate means in hand to change political democracy into its exact opposite by means of their direct and indirect influence on public opinion. Through financial domination of party, press, film, and literature, through social influence over schools and universities, they are able, without using corruption, to influence the bureaucratic and electoral apparatus in such a consummate fashion that they preserve every democratic form while achieving a dictatorship of content." This is where the theory of the material constitution is most directly relevant to socialists. It aligns almost perfectly with certain observations made by Karl Marx in, for instance, in his work On the Jewish Question, it's titled, published in 1844, where he observes a distinction on the one hand between human beings as private citizens and human beings as citizens under a political state. And he observes, talking about the bills of rights that came out of the French Revolution, that these laws, these civil rights, on the one hand, promise us freedom and equality and the right to vote in some way. And yet, at the same time, as private citizens, we are exploited and treated in conditions of subservience and inequality. The sort of liberal ideologies that came in the wake of the French Revolution tore away the old medieval restrictions on what individuals could or could not do, depending on what class they were born into. And in this sense, liberalism gave us a promise of freedom, yet it replaced these legal barriers on individuals on the basis of rank and birth. The liberal world that came about after the French Revolution replaced these legal barriers with economic ones. And so in theory, we all have the same rights as billionaires. We have the same right as Elon Musk to own property, the same right as Jeff Bezos to spend our money however we want, to succeed through our own hard work. But of course, we know the very real limits placed on individuals which prevent us from exercising our choices freely. And it's exactly this hypocrisy to which Karl Marx is seeking to draw attention to. This hypocrisy whereby the laws, the human rights, the civil rights, the constitutions promise us formal freedom, whilst in reality giving us only inequality. And this applies both to the concept of freedom and the concept of democracy. I think we have to remember just how recent the invention of universal suffrage is, the right to vote. For most of history, democracy has meant explicitly as well as implicitly a democracy of the masters. Ancient Greece was a democracy for slaveholders, but not for slaves or for women. The noble estates of the Middle Ages, the Magna Carta in this country, gave rights to barons, but not to serfs. And then, of course, Parliament in the 1700s was a perfect democracy between different landowners, but nobody else could vote. Nobody else had real power. And so, although today we do have universal suffrage, we have to accept that, first of all, this has been a very long and slow process to achieve, and only very, very recently. Complete universal suffrage was not achieved in this country until 1928, in France until 1944, in somewhere like Switzerland, I believe it was not until the 1970s when women were generally given the right to vote. And so we do live in a democratic society if democracy is about voting. And the constitution of our society, the formal constitution, is democratic. In the vast majority, I would say, of countries, certainly the vast majority of Western countries. Indeed, on paper, even constitutions like the Constitution of the Russian Federation is democratic. But when you start to look behind the commitments made by these constitutions and examine the realities, very, very often, in fact, in all cases, you will see that the extent to which these guarantees of rights are meaningful or enforceable depends on the real relations between different classes. Yes, it's all right, on the one hand, saying we have freedom of expression. But when the media is owned entirely by a few select groups of people, you have to question whether that right exists at all in a meaningful way. Now, for the last part of this, then, okay, we can say we accept that democracy is flawed, at least in the form it currently exists. And we can say that the idea of freedom under a capitalist society is elusive. But then you have to ask, what's the alternative? Now, trying to answer that question is far beyond the scope of this talk. Indeed, the Socialist Party has published quite a number of materials on how a socialist society would function. For anybody interested in that, who is not already familiar with it, I encourage you to look into it. But another question is, if democracy is so heavily weighted against ideas which challenge the status quo, how does one go about changing society? Marx accepts in The German Ideology, an unpublished manuscript written originally in 1846, that the ruling ideology is the ideology of the ruling class, that they own the media, they own the apparatus of education, and therefore that the influence of their ideas will always permeate society far more easily than those who oppose the status quo. Now, in the footnotes to the recently published abridged edition of The German Ideology, the academic Tom Wyman, who prepared the abridgment, notes the following. I quote, "While in bourgeois society, the working class are denied the spoils of their labour or any autonomy over it, they are in fact all powerful over the bourgeoisie, i.e. the capitalist class, since the capitalist class completely rely on them in order to produce the things they need in order to survive. All the working class really need to do is definitively assume this theoretical position and then realise it, and they will win." And this may not be a perfect answer, but it starts to give us an idea of how we can challenge or think about challenging the status quo. One thing that we must all remember is the fact that the working class are, in effect, all powerful over society, being those who, you know, do the important jobs, anything from factory work and farm labour to office work, transportation and so on. That gives a huge amount, at least in theory, of power to ordinary people to change the world. But of course, that will only get you so far. And I leave that as an open question because ultimately I'm just one person. I do not feel qualified to answer that question all on my own. I think I've got about 5 minutes left, and I would like to leave time open for if anybody has any questions. And so I will stop there. Thank you very much to listening to me going on.